The views and opinions expressed by the hosts on MadisonTalks.com are those of the host. That's why we do it. Give us a call, 608-210-1667. Thanks for listening.
Gleam Care has fought for civil rights in Madison and the country for decades. The former head of the Madison Area Urban League, Gleam, is now fighting to establish preschools for kids through his One City project. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Gleam Care. You are the sunshine
of my life. Welcome. This is Gleam Care, your host of Perspectives. I'm so excited for this show that we have today. I get to have on Dr. Michael Andrews, who is joining us from Gwinnett County, Georgia, where he is an assistant principal at the Sweetwater Middle School. They have 1,300 students at this middle school. When we start talking to Dr. Andrews, I got a few things to say about a middle school that's that big. That's high schools in America. But he can probably share a little bit about that soon. But we're really excited to have Dr. Andrews on today, and I'm personally excited. Number one, because we've known each other since we were in ninth grade in high school. He's a native Madisonian, same city I grew up in, and a great individual. We've been great friends ever since we met, actually, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about that. But before I have him introduce himself, I'm going to just share a little bit about this man. Is this is the reason why I decided to have Dr. Andrews on. We're at a time in our nation's history currently, right now, where we have so many reasons to pull apart. We have policymakers that can't seem to stop fighting each other or creating reasons to fight. We have a burgeoning population of diversity across our country, and definitely here in Madison, Wisconsin, that's forcing those of us who have wanted to see that happen to figure out ways to actually work across boundaries and borders with our friends, our neighbors, so we can take advantage of that rich diversity. At the same time, we also have people who are fighting against it. And it's presenting major obstacles for unity in our country and in our community. We also have in the backdrop of that, what people know I'm really concerned about are young people who are, in my view, they're not just getting caught in the crosshairs. They're not even being focused on in ways that they should. Now, I'm of the belief and mindset that strong children and strong families produce strong communities, and strong communities define strong states. Strong states define strong nations, and strong nations can benefit the rest of the world. And at the bottom end of that chain, I feel like we're missing great opportunities to invest in our young people. So I wanted to talk to Dr. Andrews because he is a very unique individual, unique to me when I was growing up, even when I met him. You know, he's a black guy that played hockey. He played hockey when we were kids. Now, my cousins played hockey. I tried to play hockey. I wasn't that good at it. But you know, he was a multi-sport athlete, very good athlete. So if he's ever bragged to his kids, believe him. This man could play some football. My parents who are listening know this. He played basketball. He played soccer. He did all of that. But Mike also went through a transition of going from being an okay student to a decent student to not so good a student to a good student, trying to find his focus. Also, as a young man who grew up biracial, in an adopted family with two white parents. Both of his parents, fairly prominent in the community, especially his father, Morris Andrews, who is a great man. He made the teachers unions extraordinarily strong in this state. Some people love him. There are some who hate him, but they still respect him for what he did. But Dr. Andrews, it's great to have you on, man.
Man, I am so honored to be on with you, Kaleem, and the words that you said, I just have to say one statement. It takes one to know one.
Go ahead, man.
Man, I tell you what, I'm just so honored to be on with you. And just, you know, your radio program and what you've done for the Madison community, the larger Madison community, not just the African-American community and a diverse community, but the entire community needs to be lauded, and it needs to be talked about, because you have been in the on the grind and in the trenches for years. So I just want to give you a huge shout out for what you do.
I appreciate that, brother. I appreciate it. Well, and I'm going to call him Mike, y'all, as we talk, because that's how we know him. Mike Andrews.
And Mike and Mike.
Mike and Mike. He was the dapper Don, and I was the physical one. But, Mike, let's jump into this, man. There's a lot going on in the world right now, and I really think you can help some of us really shed some light on what's happening. But tell us first, man, what was it like? I've always wanted to ask you this publicly. What was it like to grow up in Madison with the background that you had? You know, Madison's a very prosperous community, always has been, at least since we've been kids. But it hasn't always been an open community to all of us, like some people think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, given your background and everything, brother, what was it like, man? Start us there. What's it like growing up here?
Man, I'll tell you what, I pondered, you know, that question that you asked me about a couple of days ago. And the biggest thing that I could say, it's a very isolating feeling to live in a place where you're not reflected and you just don't see yourself on a daily basis. In my case, I was raised by two wonderful parents, two white parents. Just to go back in my history, I was born in Chicago, Illinois, adopted a year later in Michael Reese Hospital. So my parents adopted me in 1970, and then they moved to Wisconsin in 1972 in Madison. And so my only orientation was, you know, pretty much white values, white people. Of course, I saw other races, but it was very isolating. It was very tough. But what I say is this, and this is to anybody who's raising biracial children or adopting African American or any child that is not, you know, not your race, is just to show them love. And that's all that I was shown as a child by my two parents. And so later on, I began to come into a cultural consciousness and start to see. I don't think kids really see race. In my case, probably fifth grade, you know, maybe fourth or fifth grade, I started to see differences and say, hey, wait a minute, I don't look like everybody. You know,
yep.
Folks look different. I'm the little brown baby, right? And it was definitely a struggle. It's definitely a struggle. And I think I can attribute that struggle by having the thirst, to go out and seek a knowledge of self, because my parents knew the best that they knew how to kind of integrate me into Black society and Hispanic society and teach me these things. But of course, it takes that child to really go out and have those experiences on their own. So to answer your question, it was very isolating. I think that's the word that I would use.
Wow. You know, so when we, you know, when we met, I remember seeing in hockey, I do remember seeing, I think I told you this before, because I used to trail my cousin Colin all the time, and this young man was a phenomenal hockey player. And I remember seeing Colin Jones, who also played hockey, those people who know this man, and then you. But I didn't know you. And I just remember this curly-haired black kid with a face mask on and his skinny little neck and his little legs skating really fast, man.
But listen, the puck in us, brother, was the only dark thing on the ice, brother. It was us in the puck. Just joking.
Yeah, but you know, but meeting you, I remember your mom. I remember when we met, we connected really, really quickly. And it was funny because I always had different types of friends. You know, I think it was my family. They always loved everybody. And, you know, I didn't recognize you from those days playing hockey, but I did, you know, just saw you and said, you know, this seems like a cool guy. I was trying to find my way. I'd spent so many years in private school, 1 year in public school, in eighth grade. And we connected right away. We started hanging out. And I remember when I met your mom for the first time, it was probably a couple weeks after school started in ninth grade. And we went over to your house. And, you know, I remember he lived on, for those of you that know Madison really well, there's Edgewood High School. And he lived in that neighborhood. And I never knew that black people lived there, you know. So I actually went to your house thinking that I was going to see Mike's black mom. And then Mike's white mom, Pat, opened the door.
Right.
And she welcomed me in, and you weren't self-conscious about it at all. I was a little surprised, but we have diversity like that in my family, so it wasn't so shocking. But I just remember, man, your mom, you know, reaching out to my aunt after that and being very conscientious about wanting you to have the connection to our community. And I remember the conversation and my aunt telling me, you know, she still thinks so highly of your mom, just the connection that they formed. And so talk to us a little bit about that, man. You know, you grew up, you said you were in fourth, fifth grade, you started recognizing difference, how you were different than other young people. You know, what did your parents do, really, to help you break that, build that bridge?
Well, I'll tell you what, it's like I said before, I think that the way my parents approached adoption, and first of all, if you're going to adopt a biracial child, and I'm half Jewish and half African American, if you're going to take that step, then you need to be equipped to know, number one, what that child's going to deal with. And you need to be very honest with that child about racism, bigotry, and so forth. My parents were really aware. Did they know exactly how to, you know, teach me about being a black male in America? Absolutely not. They never had that experience. So why would I expect them to? But what they did is they showed me, you know, so much love. And I think the thing that really helped me out was athletics. And you talked about, you know, some of my aspirations or my perceived greatness, which he's really, really stretching. I wasn't that great, brother. You were much, much better athlete than I was. But what I think the connection with my father being a former football coach was that I went to camps, and sports was the way to link me to other black athletes. And, you know, even the white athletes were very, I think they were a little bit more receptive to black folks, even in the 80s in Wisconsin. Wisconsin's a sports crazy town, man. We know that. And so, you know, if you show some talent, I think you get a little bit more shine. I think you get a little bit more attention. And I think I thrived on that, a bit of that attention. But my parents, one of the things that I remember them doing is they would talk to me about all cultures. And they were very open to teaching me not just about African-American culture, but all cultures. And they were very critical of each one. So they didn't do it inauthentically and contrived, like I'm going to teach this young black boy black history. They just continued to show me the truth. And as I saw the truth, I was able to kind of understand that, yeah, I had a different family. I had a white mom and I had a black mom. But at the end of the day, brother, I had two parents that loved me. And I knew I could go home each and every night in a safe environment. And so I think my message, again, to those who adopt and have biracial children or children is just show them love and get your informal doctorate on how to understand diverse cultures and give them nuggets along the way. You don't have to teach them every single thing about their culture, but that is a great opportunity for a child who's raised in a different culture to be really balanced. Now, in my case, bro, and I'm not trying to go on too far here, but I hope I answered your question, but I think that if you are immersed in one culture and then you don't know the other side, you begin to immerse yourself in the other culture. Example for me, when I went to Florida A&M, the historical black college, I didn't want to have anything to do with white folks. I didn't want to talk to white folks. I wanted to be in a complete black incubator. And that was great for me. But at a certain point, there had to be a balance. So when I graduated Florida A&M and I came to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and because of you, bro, and I got to give you so many props because you were the one who exposed me to the Teach for Diversity program run by Gloria Lassen-Billings and Dr. Lassen-Billings and Dr. Gomez.
Gomez.
Yes, and they did an awesome job. And I think that was kind of my bridge to coming back to a balance. But the immersion had to happen for me in terms of being at a HBCU. So I'm saying this to say if there are parents of, you know, students and you are a white parent or you know, you've got to allow and be open for your child to be immersed in each culture to learn, you know, who they are. And I think I got a real good knowledge of self at Florida A&M. That was my real, kickoff point in terms of me kind of understanding my history and my culture. So I hope that answers that question. Sorry to ramble on.
No, that's all right. We're going to come back to that. But, Mike, we're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, I also want to dive in with you about your real parents, because the other thing is you know those two families and you've gotten very involved.
Yes,
and so I want to talk about that more when we get back. This is Kaleem Care on Perspectives. We'll be back in a moment.
MadisonTalks.com is the home of Madison's most creative talk radio. If you have a serious gift of gab, you have stories to share, political, social, or religious positions to express, contact Madison Talks to have your own 60-minute weekly podcast recorded and posted for the world to hear. Have a new book to promote? Madison Talks is the ideal place to promote it. Fly solo or line up guests for your weekly live talk session. When your 60-minute program is finished live streaming, it'll be posted as a podcast to MadisonTalks.com for listening 24/7. Take your message to the world with MadisonTalks.com. Call 608-210-1667 or visit MadisonTalks.com. That's 608-210-1667 or visit MadisonTalks.com. MadisonTalks.com, looking for your creative commentary. You're listening to MadisonTalks.com, stimulating conversation on a variety of subjects and issues that matter. Share your questions, comments, or answers with us at 608-210-1667. Now here's your host on MadisonTalks.com.
All right, this is Kaleem Care. I'm back with my guest, Dr. Michael Andrews of Gwinnett County, Georgia. A great educator down there who grew up here in his hometown of ours called Madison, Wisconsin. And we're talking about his experiences. We spent the last segment talking about his experiences being adopted, being an African-American biracial child, being adopted by two great white, great parents who happen to be white. But Mike, talk to us a bit, man, about your parents, because as you've taken this journey, I feel like I've taken it with you, because you've always been very open about sharing your experiences, your explorations. You got an opportunity to meet your father's family, and you've also had an opportunity to meet your mother. Tell us about your parents. Tell us about those experiences, man.
Well, at age 21, I was down in Tallahassee, Florida, and I received a letter from a counselor that dealt with my adoption back in 1970. And she, in so many words, said, I'm the counselor that, dealt with your adoption. Your biological mother would like to reach out to you. And please call me at this number. This is before, bro, this was before cell phones. And this was before the internet. So you had to call people. I don't know if you remember that.
I do.
Had to call folks. So I gave her a call, and I said, absolutely, I want to meet her. So to make a long story short, I was able to contact and get in contact with my biological mother by the name of Nancy Hanover, beautiful woman, and she lived in California. And come to find out, she was a teacher and retired as an art teacher in Los Angeles, California. So that teaching is definitely in my blood. Education's in my blood. But what happened, man, the interesting part was she went back to Chicago. And I really wanted to find my father. Obviously, a young man wants to know his father. All young men want to know their father. And so we went back to Chicago, and I found my aunt, and I have eight cousins from from my father's mother, who lives in Chicago now, and we found that my father had passed away at age 19. But interestingly enough, and this is a twist to the story, he actually died in Green Bay, Wisconsin, in prison. I believe one of the prisons up there is the Waupun, that close to Green Bay.
The Waupun's not, but it's the Green Bay Correctional Facility.
It was the Green Bay, yes, mm-hmm. Exactly. It was the Green Bay Correctional Facility, and he had passed away at age 19. But he had done some stick-ups. He had done some robberies in Madison. And so I was 1 year old when he was actually in the same town. I was adopted by both of my parents. And here he was in town doing some pretty nefarious stuff. And so it's amazing, and God is so amazing that I was able to link up with both families and have a wonderful relationship with them. And then my adopted parents also know them. They've met them. Man, I couldn't ask for anything else. But again, to know your roots and to know where you come from, I am so blessed because I talk to a lot of people that are adopted, and they, number one, may not want to find their biological parents, or they are attempting and can't find those parents. So I'm so fortunate to have that, to know both sides. And the interesting thing about it, Colleen, is that, you know, you meet somebody at age 21, it's kind of like you're starting all over again. Mm. So I'm learning more about myself, and I'm learning more about my history and my culture, my true history and culture, through these folks. And just to tell you a funny story, as I was at Florida A&M, and I won't call out the kind of the radical group that I immersed myself in, but we talked about Jews and Jewish people pretty harsh. Mm-hmm. And come to find out, I was half Jewish myself, bro. So I tell you, man, God has a great sense of humor, and you never know where you come from. So culture diversity and diversity is very important. We all are part of one another.
You know, I don't think people understand that, too. At least some folks don't. When you just said, you know, you went through this period, you and I both know we both went through that same period coming from Madison, not seeing a reflection of yourself outside of, you know, your general community. And really not seeing black people in positions of influence. You know, I know several of our friends from high school who are white or were listening to this, because the beautiful thing about our experience as children is, man, we had good friends from every background. Yeah. And we looked out for each other. We played together. We hung together. That's the part of our country in Madison that I'm missing as an adult more and more.
Yes.
But the identity issue, you know, because we didn't see ourselves, especially when we were coming into our own. Once I got to Hampton University, and even before that, I was in San Diego. I was in the military. I was in the Navy, and I started to see more black men in positions of influence and more black women in positions of influence. I started to become more frustrated with my experience in Madison because I felt like people intentionally held me back from something.
Mm-hmm.
I started to question the education that I received. I started to question the relationships that I had. And I, too, went through, they call it this racial identity development, that this phase that you go through where I didn't want to see white people. I didn't want to talk to white people. Now, it was pretty quick. It was fast for me. I got through that probably within about a year. But there was a period where, in terms of just discovering myself, I got frustrated with others. I don't think a lot of people understand that the consequences of inequality and lack of diversity, not only does it have a negative impact on young people's experiences themselves and their own access to opportunity, it also has a negative and can have a negative impact, at least for a little while, on how they might view others. And so, you know, that's a serious statement that you made, man. What helped you move beyond that, Mike? What helped you, like, as you were becoming an adult, coming into yourself, you went through this phase of being a part of radical groups. What was it, man, that when you started to make this transition where you yourself started to become more open as a man?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think a lot of brothers go through that, especially, and I can only say my experience, your experience too, as a black male. I think there's a rage that's inside of us that if it's directed in the right way, you become really, really powerful. And the reason I say that, man, is because when I was so immersed in Black consciousness and so immersed in learning the knowledge of self, there came a point where I could always default back to my upbringing in Madison. And what you mentioned right there, man, so powerful. The great relationships that we built in high school with white, Black, Hispanic, Indian, you name it, Madison was that melting pot. But I think in the formative years of a young person's life, if they don't see themselves reflected, it can really affect their identity and really affect, if they don't see positive reflections of who they are on a daily basis, it can really affect them negatively. And I think that's what happened to me. But I want to caveat that by saying that even though there was a lack of positive images, Black male and Black images for us, the images of other folks and the way that they treated us were awesome. And I say that by, and you know this too, being on a football team at Madison West, and we bonded together. It didn't matter what color you were, man. It didn't matter what you spoke. You know, we had Nigerians on the team, brother. We had Asians. We had everybody on that team.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to default back to my time in Madison and say, you know what? I've seen diversity work for the right reason. Now, does that mean that I had to stay there? No. Does that mean that you had to stay there? No. We had to venture out. You had to go to Hampton. We had to go to historically Black colleges. That was our avenue to find out who we were. But you know what? You can't live in that one space forever. And I think it's dangerous to live in a space where you only want to see folks that look like you. And my charge was, bro, I love Black folks so much that I don't understand why people are not in love with us. We got an amazing story. We got a story to teach. We got a story to tell folks, man. And I want to be able to tell that to a rural white guy from Wisconsin who has never come in contact with the history and culture of Black folks. I want to teach him. Because, interestingly enough, man, I was kind of like doing my research down at Florida A&M, and I would come back and tell my mother things, my adopted mother. And she would say, wow, I didn't know that. And she also moved down to Atlanta and helped me raise two of my children, Jelani Andrews and Khadijah Andrews. And she was immersed into the lifestyle and the Black culture of Atlanta. You know, so there's so many avenues that we got to take, man, and we got to be open to one another's culture. But I just feel like if you're not balanced, man, you're missing out on so much. You're missing out on tons of things. So, yeah, it's been a blessing, bro.
And, you know, your mom, man, you mentioned Miss Pat. I call her Miss Pat. I got to say Miss in front of every woman's name who's a little older than me. I feel my grandmother and them pulling on my ear if I don't. But, you know, my experience just meeting her, man, was, and I had great experiences meeting people like that. She was such a great coach, always giving great advice, and also always just very inspiring. When we come back, man, I want to talk about our peer group and what it was like to grow up in that. And then I'm going to start taking some calls from people who want to call in, and I'll share that number with you when I come back. This is Kaleem Kerr on Perspectives. We'll be back in a minute.
MadisonTalks.com is the home of Madison's most creative talk radio. If you have a serious gift of gab, you have stories to share, political, social, or religious positions to express, contact Madison Talks to have your own 60-minute weekly podcast recorded and posted for the world to hear. Have a new book to promote? Madison Talks is the ideal place to promote it. Fly solo or line up guests for your weekly live talk session. When your 60-minute program is finished live streaming, it'll be posted as a podcast to MadisonTalks.com for listening 24/7. Take your message to the world with MadisonTalks.com. Call 608-210-1667 or visit MadisonTalks.com. That's 608-210-1667 or visit MadisonTalks.com. MadisonTalks.com, looking for your creative commentary. You're listening to MadisonTalks.com, stimulating conversation on a variety of subjects and issues that matter. Share your questions, comments, or answers with us at 608-210-1667. Now here's your host on MadisonTalks.com.
All right, this is Kaleem Kerr. I'm back with my guest, Dr. Michael Andrews, on this show, Perspectives, getting his perspective on what it's like to grow up in this community, grow up with his background. And also, we're going to jump in now and talk about what it was like, just briefly, Mike, man, what was it like, you know, for our peer group, man? I mean, we had such a diverse peer group, but we've had young men and women who were more talented than us. Some went on to do exceptional things. Others have done great things in their own right, but I think some would say they did not live up to their potential. A lot of them stayed here. What is it for those of us that were able to get out at least for a little while from home? What is it about those who have stayed, who struggled more here? Why were they struggling so much, man? And you know, give us some your perspective on that. What's held some of us back here?
Yeah. Well, I want to give you a huge shout out, Kaleem, because you were one of those people that was so balanced. And I joke with our sons all the time that you were the mayor. You knew everybody in town in high school. And, you know, you knew the community. And you were able to go out and you were able to venture out to San Diego, to Hampton University, to Washington, D.C., and but you had the knowledge that you brought back from those places, and you meant to help out the greater Madison community. So I just want to give you a shout out for that. And those peer groups that you talk about always talk about you, and we always say, man, how blessed we are to have you back, and you making the Madison community a better place for all people. But to answer your question about the peer group and those who, quote-unquote, made it and those who stayed and had difficulties, I think it's exactly what you said. I think that if you are in an isolating environment where you only see powerful images, and I want to talk about the men here in particular. I know it happens with the women, too, but for a male, there's a natural inclination for a man to feel a sense of power, to feel a sense of worth. And if you are waking up every day and you're going to school and you don't see a black professor, you don't see an African-American doctor, an African-American lawyer, the only thing that you see is on television. And you take a trip down to Chicago on the weekend and you get inspired, but you come back with the same old thing. That can really wear on you, man. And you and I both know that we have talked since we were 18 years old about the lack of black male figures of empowerment, empowering figures. The ones that were there were awesome. I got to give a huge shout out to Mr. Ed Holmes, Mr. Joe Thomas. Those are two that just pop into my mind. Without those two brothers right there, man, I'm not even here right now. Okay, right. I'm not here. Because they showed me what black manhood was. But if you are, let's just take this. Let's just say the father's not in the home, okay? And let's say the mother's doing the best she can. And you don't see those examples on a daily basis. Man, it begins to create a huge gap, a huge identity gap. And some of us have not been able to make up that gap, man. So what do you fall into? I don't know. You're going to fall into whatever you're going to fall into. You're left up to your own devices. And unfortunately, a lot of us in our peer group neither had some didn't have the will, some didn't have the finance, and some didn't have the help to get out. for just a while. And unfortunately, many of them didn't make it. Some of them are dead. Some of them are languishing in drug abuse and a whole bunch of stuff. And that's not to say that we don't struggle too, man. We struggle with what we struggle with. But, man, I tell you what, the fact of the matter is that you were able to see another side of the world. So was I. And I think when we can go back to Madison, we can enrich that town and we can enrich the people in that town by showing them those experiences, by showing them that there's black folks out here that are doing amazing things. And you may not see that in Madison. And to be honest with you, that's what made me leave. It's a great place to live, but you got to have a balance. So I hope I answered your question, man. I'm going on and on.
You did. No. And I'm going to put the number out there for people that might want to call in and ask you some questions. You might have some old friends out there. If an old girlfriend calls you, don't do that. Don't call him in here. No. No, but the area code is 608-210-1667. 608-210-1667. If you want to call and offer your question to Dr. Andrews here, please do. If you're sitting near your computer, just go to madisontalks.com and the phone number's right there for you. I would be happy to take your call. But Mike, let me ask you too. You went into education. You talked a lot about experiences growing up. I know a lot of that motivated you to choose education. You know, why did you decide to go into that field, and what have you seen in it that inspires you, and what have you seen that concerns you?
Oh, man, let me tell you something. And I think I can give Madison a huge shout-out for the way that we were prepared at West High School, you know, an academically rigorous environment. And then being able to be balanced at Florida A&M University. So I got the cultural consciousness with the academic rigor in Madison. So, you know, education is in my blood. Again, my mother, 30 years educated in Los Angeles. Father, VX, executive secretary, president there, and building the union. So, I mean, I grew up seeing what education can do. And the great things that can be accomplished with the right education. And Kaleem, we just had this talk the other day about desiring an education system that is not sterile, an education system that is based around student interest and students teaching them that the difference between an A and an F is not intelligence, but it's really discipline. I didn't receive a PhD because I'm smarter than any other person. I did it because I just had the perseverance to get through. And I think that's what we have to start teaching our kids. I've been in education for 18 years in the classroom, been on the front lines, fourth, fifth, and sixth grade teacher. And I just now, this is my first year as an assistant principal. And what I try to get over to my 17 language arts teachers is you have got to get connected to the life worlds of your students. You have to know you have to create culturally relevant lessons. Thank you, Dr. Lassen-Billings, for teaching me that. But if you're not talking to them, you're not talking to their soul, you know, you're really not moving the needle, as it were, with education. So the way education should be approached with myself as 18 years in the classroom and now as a leader at a middle school is that we've got to inspire our kids. We've got to inspire our students. We have to inspire our parents. We have to inspire our teachers not to just teach the curriculum, to get a four-year degree, to go and get a job, create a job. Make it so that, and I like this term, make the life of the mind sexy. Make the life of the mind sexy. Make it attractive. Because I tell you what, if you can teach a child that knowledge is so sexy, they will go into whatever field that they want to and make something of it and make a contribution to the society to make it a better society, right? So that's really, my approach to education is man, make it open, make it diverse, make those lessons culturally relevant for your students. And I'm attempting to do that with my 17 teachers that I work with right now. And I tell you what, man, we're doing some great things at Sweetwater Middle School. If you're ever in Georgia, Gwinnett County, please come and see us. 1,400 kids, 64% of our kids are Latino, the rest African-American, Asian. We have a few whites sprinkled in there as well. 94% of our students are on free and reduced lunch, right? Okay, so when you look at our school from the outside, you're going to say what? Okay, you know, this is something like Dangerous Minds, okay? This is something like some movie. Brother, we're doing some magnificent work with our kids. I mean, it's amazing what you can do with a dedicated staff of people who care about kids, and you do have to love kids.
Give us an example.
Love them.
Give us an example of what you guys are doing. Give us an example.
Yeah, okay. Well, the school, our school feeds into a high school, Berkmar High School. Berkmar High School has only 61% of our students at Berkmar High School graduate high school in 4 years. I'll say that again. Only 61% of our students graduate from high school in 4 years. So we have the lowest, and let me just say this, we've got 178,000 students in Gwinnett County Public Schools. I said 178,000. We're the 13th largest district in the country. And this high school is massive. It's huge. And what we're doing, our goal is to reduce that graduation rate in 2 years. We're going to reduce the graduation rate.
You mean increase it?
Excuse me. We're going to increase the graduation rate. Sorry. We're going to increase that graduation rate in 2 years. And the way we do it, man, we got a scholarship fund. We have teachers that are committed to come to our school. We have a new policy now where when teachers come in and they come into Title I schools, we're going to pay for performance. So if their observations are really good and when they show progress, when they show growth from year, you know, from the beginning of the year to the end of the year, they're going to be paid based on that. Are we trying to get the best teacher candidates out there? Absolutely we are. We're absolutely trying to do that. But we have a dedicated staff. And let me tell you something. At the end of the year in most schools, you might have a 20% or 30% turnover rate, folks that are hitting the button and want to go other places. Brother, we had five teachers out of our 85 on staff that wanted to leave. And many of that was because they wanted to relocate. So we have a dedicated staff of educators of all cultures that come to school every day and make a difference for our kids. And our kids, we have, and let me say this too, when you think of middle school, what do you think about? Discipline, right? Well, only I believe it's 0.89% of our students have four referrals or above. So that means 99% of our kids only have 0 to 3 referrals. That's discipline referrals. That says a lot about what we're doing as we implemented our PBIS program. Those of you in education know the PBIS program. It is going very well. And I'm saying that if you get a chance to come up and see the great work that's going on at Sweetwater Middle School, please come up and check us out.
So if there's anyone that wants to call in, again, the number 608-210-1667, 608-210-1667. We'll put you on hold until we come back. This is Kaleem Care with Perspectives. We'll be back in a minute.
MadisonTalks.com is the home of Madison's most creative talk radio. If you have a serious gift of gab, you have stories to share, political, social, or religious positions to express, contact Madison Talks to have your own 60-minute weekly podcast recorded and posted for the world to hear. Have a new book to promote? Madison Talks is the ideal place to promote it. Fly solo or line up guests for your weekly live talk session. When your 60-minute program is finished live streaming, it'll be posted as a podcast to MadisonTalks.com for listening 24/7. Take your message to the world with MadisonTalks.com. Call 608-210-1667 or visit MadisonTalks.com. That's 608-210-1667 or visit MadisonTalks.com. MadisonTalks.com. Looking for your creative commentary. You're listening to MadisonTalks.com. Stimulating conversation on a variety of subjects and issues that matter. Share your questions, comments, or answers with us at 608-210-1667. Now here's your host on MadisonTalks.com.
All right, it's Kaleem Kerr. I'm back with Dr. Michael Andrews of Gwinnett County, Georgia, talking about his experience growing up in Madison. And we just finished getting some insight from him on what they're doing in his school, Sweetwater Middle School in Gwinnett County, to address the achievement challenges that they face there. Now, an interesting thing, Dr. Andrews, is that we've talked about this before, too, but Georgia historically has had one of the lowest performing education systems in the country. And I had the opportunity as a member of President Barack Obama's Race to the Top initiative. I was one of the 62 expert reviewers for that program. And Georgia was one of my states. And I had the opportunity to get to meet your governor and some other people as a result of that work. And they had this goal of one of the things was how they would measure educators using this new educator effectiveness tool for determining how effective a teacher was. And it included everything from observations to student test scores, to reflections by teachers, to evidence of their practice from their students' ongoing work, lesson plan reviews, those types of things. And I found it fascinating, and is some of those things have been implemented around the state, this educative effectiveness tool. How has that gone in Georgia? You said you're getting teachers, you're working more with them. Are the measurements and the evaluations and things we're doing of teachers, is it really effective? Or are you finding that the results for your teachers and their improvements are coming from somewhere else?
You mean by coming from somewhere else? What do you mean?
Like, is it the tool, the way we're evaluating teachers now, that's making a difference in the education of the education of providing our children and the quality of their work as teachers, or is it coming from somewhere else?
Yeah, I think one of the great things about teaching in a Title I school, and Gwinnett County has quite a few Title I schools, we are able to see more growth in our kids than a lot of schools in the northern area of some of the wealthier schools. So this is just being implemented next year with our county, is to have teachers, number one, to look at observations and look how they're doing, and to really be honest with them about what their administrators are seeing in the classroom. Is teaching and learning going on? You know, we're in the business of teaching and learning. The next year, what will happen is that it's going to be phased in. That will the pay for performance will start next year based on the observation. But then the next year, it'll start with just test scores alone, and it will show growth. So here you are. If you're a new teacher and you want to come to Gwinnett County Public Schools, what a great opportunity to come to a Title I school, because here's where you'll be able to take your students from you know, and I'm just assuming, you know, this is definitely an assumption. If your students are low performing, you are able to move your kids up, you know, higher throughout the year, and you're going to be paid based on that performance. What we're seeing at our school is we see huge, huge growth from the beginning of the year until right now. We take our standardized testing, obviously, coming up here in the next week. But even by the end of the school year, man, you're able to see not only the academic but the social growth of 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. This is something that Gwinnett County is spearheading. It is the only Metro Atlanta school that is doing this. So other school districts will probably see what happens. The state has not even done it yet. We're ahead of the state here, and we're trying to get ahead of what's to come, what is to come. So we'll see what happens. Pay for performance in some states. I know in Denver, and I know they did some studies out there, and it didn't really sustain itself that well. But in a huge district like ours, and I can just speak for my school alone, I have seen the huge growth of our students from day one to right now. And you know, our teachers are on board for it, and it's going to attract some really good candidates already. And that's what I'm saying as well.
Well, I'm sitting in a state where pay for performance is a dirty, dirty phrase, man. But it's great to hear that, at least in your case, you know, it's going well. I also want to touch on real quick for our listeners, too, because people have asked me, you know, Colleen, why are you doing this show? And why are you focused on these broad topics? I decided to do a show, one, because the executive producer of this show, Mitch Hank, he's a good friend, a mentor in this regard to me. He encouraged me to do it. But second, and more important than that, it is very difficult as a community organizer who doubles as a business person to try to organize people when they don't want to talk to each other, when they don't want to listen to each other, when they don't want to hear somebody else's point of view. I have been raked over coals many times over the course of the last 20 years of my career because of my support of school vouchers for poor kids or charter schools or supporting friends of mine who are Republicans, you know, or conservatives. It's like I catch it one way or the other. And where I think I've benefited professionally and definitely personally in my soul is I've been able to get to a place in my life where those people who are really not good people, they if they're very public, they tend to stand out. You know who they are, and they're easier to address. But I tend to look for the good in people, and it allows me to live a life where, you know, I'm not fearful. I definitely am not overconfident, but I'm not fearful of engaging people and hearing what they have to say. So I was talking to my wife about this, and I said, you know, Lisa, what should I call this? And she hit it right on the head. She said, you're always looking for people's perspective. You should call it that. So that's how it got the name. But at the base of this, my work right now is to lead One City Early Learning Centers. And I want to see, along with a number of others of us who are supporting the development of this school, a state, a community where early education, high quality early education and high quality public education is not just a right, but an opportunity for every child. And there's policy change and things that have to happen in order to get there. But we'll never get to policy change if we don't start hearing each other out and developing relationships and broadening our willingness to hear other people's point of view. So I'm trying to do whatever I possibly can to send the message to people that hearing people's points of view is so vitally important to our ability to connect with each other on a personal and professional level to get to the point where we can make some decisions together. So I've been fortunate to have Dr. Andrews on this show today to offer his perspective on his life growing up, on his personal experience, but also on education. Mike, we're going to wrap it up here shortly, but something that I hope you can send us home with, man. What suggestion would you give us for how we can move our children forward who are struggling right now, whether it be family circumstance or personal circumstance? What can you leave us professionals and just citizens who are listening to you with some words of wisdom?
Yeah, I think, in my 20 years being in education, the things that I've learned just as a young man in Madison, us being friends, I think one of the things, something that I referenced earlier, is to connect to the life worlds of your students. And when you do that, you really make the life of the mind sexy for these young people out here. It's going to take a lot of work. You're in the trenches. I thank God for you, Colleen, for your One City Learning. And what you're doing on the front end to prepare these young people to be critical thinkers, to teach the whole child. I know we hear that in the research, But to teach holistically means that you're not just teaching academic knowledge. You're also teaching students how to be caring, how to be loving, how to be open, how to think in a diverse a way when they deal with people that don't think like them, don't look like them. We have to get out of our own cocoon. And by getting out of our own cocoon, we have to engage those that are different from us. And I think that's where learning starts. I think when you engage those who are different from you, I think the learning process starts there. I think if we begin to stay on that line and be very linear and say, this is the way it is, and I'm not going to go left, I'm not going to go right, that's really the death of our learning. And I'll just give you a quote to leave. And this comes from the Quran, actually. It says, the man or woman that goes out in the search of knowledge should never return. The man and women who are in search of knowledge should never return, because knowledge is infinite. So that means that I can learn from the brother on the street. I can learn from the brother or sister up in the state house. I can learn from everybody because I'm open enough to know that my way is not the way, but it's God's way. And I think if we come in and we teach our children that, we're going to have a successful society and we're going to have a beautiful society. And I just appreciate you bringing me on today, brother. I really am honored to be on your program.
And I'm honored to have you on here. We're going to have some great shows coming up next week. I will be off on spring break. I'm taking my three sons across the country to San Diego on a road trip, something we've been wanting to do for years. We're going to visit some great schools along the way, make it part work, part personal. But also after that, the next week, the Tuesday following on the 18th, I'm going to have three Latina women on here to talk about their experiences growing up in this country and in this community. And then on April 25th, I will have the Dr. Howard Fuller, education reform guru, international guru, and then also an international guru, Dr. Gloria Ladson Billings, on the same show talking about the future of African-American education. I'm looking forward to that. Dr. Andrews, thank you for being on with us today.
Thank you so much.
So great to have you. Again, everyone, thank you for listening. This is Kaleem Carroll Perspectives. We'll be back in 2 weeks.